Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
Hey, it's Jeff here. What you're about to hear is the recording from our weekly Context and Clarity live show that I co-host with Catherine McPhail. Every week we bring in a special guest that will help us dig even deeper and find even more clarity around the most popular Context and Clarity topics. This version of Context and Clarity is simulcast to Facebook and LinkedIn and YouTube and Twitch. Oh, and did I mention that they're live? We're operating without a net, so we may hit a few rough patches and stumble every once in a while. But I think these guests and these conversations are important enough that we really shouldn't keep them to ourselves. So with that, let's jump into this week's episode. This episode of Context and Clarity is supported by Twinmotion, the simple real-time rendering solution to create high-quality imagery, client presentations, and interactive experiences that help communicate your design ideas fast. To learn more, visit Twinmotion at twinmotion.link/clarity. This episode of the Context and Clarity podcast is also supported by Section Cut, the interactive virtual conference from our friends at Monograph. Learn more at sectioncut.com.
All right, Entree Architect community, it's 4 p.m. Eastern, which means it's time for the Entree Architect Context and Clarity live conversation for, what is this, Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. Welcome back, everybody. We're back after a two-week break. Great to have all of you joining us today. I already see people saying hi. Great to have you here. Kurt in Flint, Michigan, and Chris all the way over there in Massachusetts. Benita, hello, and Atlanta, Margarita from South Florida, Yoko in Virginia. Yoko has identified herself, which reminds me, you see on the screen in the comments, some of you have pictures, some of you don't. Some of you have names, some of you don't. Some of you are just known as Facebook user, which we've learned not to abbreviate. If you show up as Facebook user but would prefer to show up with your actual profile, there's a URL in the bottom left of your screen right now, chat.restream.io/FB, as in Facebook. Go ahead and click that and give Facebook permission to publish your picture and your name, and then you'll show up as who you are instead of as the Facebook user. If you don't want to do that, that's fine as well, but just throwing that out there in case you want to be identified as such. John Kenny, I see you listening. I see you. I hear you listening. I don't know. You're listening. You hear us. Great to have you back from Massachusetts. And Jefferson. Jefferson says he's handing over the crocheted bathtub to Ryan Shoup. Congratulations, Ryan. First in today. Congratulations on the grand award of the crocheted bathtub. Glad all of you are coming back from, I see Facebook. I see LinkedIn. We'll see if we find any friends from YouTube or Twitch today. Maybe we'll get another troll from Twitch. That'd be a good goal to have.
I hope so.
Yeah, we know that we have made it back if we get a troll today. That'll be fun. Christian, we see you up there in Ithaca, New York. Everybody else, say hi when you get here. Good number of people coming in, getting it warmed up here. Remembering how this thing works after being off for 2 weeks. So welcome back. Brian McCarthy, see you over there on LinkedIn. Glad that you're here. Nicole wants to know if she can troll from Facebook. You can, but that question.
You should probably take your name off there, Nicole, if you're going to troll. Just a tip.
Yeah, and it makes me think that if you ask that question, you probably need the tutorial on trolling, which you can download at entrearchitect.com/troll. Just go check that out if you're interested. But anyway, thank you for joining us. Great to be back here today. We've got another great guest today here on our live conversation. I'm looking forward to jumping into this. So, Catherine, what did I miss? Other than 2 weeks, what did I miss?
Yeah, 2 weeks. I think we should just jump right in. I think you're all set.
Okay.
We've said hello. Right. I'm saying hello from Massachusetts.
Yeah, Catherine's back. Catherine's back in the house, off the vineyard.
Yeah.
Everybody's
I didn't have to leave Massachusetts to go to the vineyard, though, so.
Yeah.
It wasn't as big of a vacation as you had.
Yeah, well, you're stuck in the state. I'm stuck in the white box, and here we are. We're all back together.
We're all stuck.
Again. We're all stuck. Joker's on the left. All right. Here we go. Well, I'm just going to go ahead and introduce our guest today. I've been looking forward to this for a while, and there's a couple people in our audience that have been looking forward to this for a while as well. Our guest today is an accidental archivist and a Hepcat audiophile. A trip to Falling Water led to a late-night Google search, which led to him being a founder, which led to him being an executive director, a tour guide, and a podcast host. He's a modernist soul trapped in a modern body and the purveyor of the largest open digital archive of residential mid-century modernist architecture in the world. He's no Mr. Rogers, but he is Mr. Modernism. George Smart, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Hey, thank you. And now I want to learn how to be a troll too. I didn't know there was a tutorial page on your site, but now I know I can go there and learn this valuable skill.
Oh, it is a valuable skill. I've heard there's quite a career in it. So, go to entrearchitect.com/troll. We'll have that PDF posted before the show is over.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us today, George. Like I said, there's several people that, in fact, I see Chris Novelli there in the comments. He's he did his thesis, his MArch thesis. And I'm sure he will. There he goes, right in the comments. It was on preservation of modern architecture. So there's a few
Thank
folks.
You, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for your service right there. Yeah.
Chris and others have been waiting a long time for this. So I want to start out with this. You know, you're Mr. Modernism, U.S. Modernist, NC Modernist. So those of you out there, that are listening to this, NC as in North Carolina, which is where George lives. So U.S. Modernist and NC Modernist. Why modernism? That's the question.
Okay. Well, we could go many different ways with that. Like, why is modernism fun? Why was modernism popular? Why is it not popular for you? Modernism for me is just because it has a good vibe.
Okay.
It feels happy and optimistic and about the future. And that was what was so attractive to most people who loved it when it came out. It was no longer about looking backwards or to styles of 100 or 500 years ago. It was not a classical view. It was a hopeful view. It was going to take us to the Jetsons. We were going to have flying cars and, you know, robotic servants around the house and two-way wrist radios and a laser gun. We got the wrist radios,
but we
haven't gotten the laser guns quite yet.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for my flying Mini Cooper, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day. So, okay, the follow-up question then, and those, if you've never listened to U.S. Modernist Radio, first of all, go to wherever you download podcasts, wherever you consume podcasts, go there and check out U.S. Modernist Radio. It's George's podcast. It's wonderful. It's a great mix of modernism and music and a lot of things. So my second question is, why jazz?
Why jazz? We have a music segment on the show, which we started about 2 years ago. And it's because if you go on some of these mid-century modern tours, what are they playing inside the house? It's jazz.
Right.
So we started inviting different jazz artists to come on the show, thinking nobody would show up. And we've had like 40 of them so far. We have one about every other show.
Yeah, that's a fun segment. I when I first found your podcast, and you know, I'm clicking around on different different titles and things. And of course, I had to listen to the episode on the Ferris Bueller house. I lived in the Chicago.
That was very fun. Yeah,
that was a great episode. Yeah, I lived in Chicago for about 20 years, and of course, you've got to listen to the Ferris Bueller episode. But the jazz segment is fantastic, and it made me think. Have you ever watched the show Bosch on Prime, on Amazon Prime?
Only every episode of every season, Jeff. So go ahead, let's go with it. Come on, let's Bosch a little.
I'm listening to the podcast, Modernism, got the jazz. I'm going, Harry Bosch.
Harry Bosch, exactly. Yep. And that house is a real house in the Hollywood Hills. They don't shoot there live all the time, just a little bit. They have a soundstage. It recreates the inside of the house. But it's one of those stellar modernist houses that was built between the late 40s and the early 60s with the spectacular view of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Very similar to the most famous house in LA, which is the Stahl House.
Okay.
Which has been in so many TV shows and movies, and in that same general vicinity.
What's the name, or is there a name for the house that's in the show Bosch?
It doesn't have like a popular name,
right?
Okay. But it's a real place. If you go on Google, you can look it up and see pictures of it. I think there are even some old MLS listings. You can see photos of the inside.
Got it. Yeah. I'm thinking as you're talking, is the Bosch House, so now it's got a name, is the Bosch House in your archive?
It is not, because we are organized by architect. And so we've not gotten to that particular architect yet.
Got it.
What we'll do is take someone like Pierre Koenig, who designed the Stahl House. And then our research team will dig deep and find every house that Koenig designed. And sometimes some unbuilt ones. And then we'll put all of that online as one great documentation of his work.
And we should say, I skipped over this part. We've got sort of a circuitous route to this point that on usmodernist.org, as I mentioned in the intro for George, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the largest open digital archive of information on mid-century modern, especially residential, I guess, mid-century modern houses. Okay.
Yeah, we have about 2 terabytes of content, which is a lot.
That is a lot.
In fact, when we started out, we couldn't find a server in North America that we could afford. So we ended up moving to Germany for our server services. And now America's caught up. So I think we're in Kansas somewhere now with Dorothy and Oz.
See, that's backwards.
Where everything lives.
Not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things that just blew me away when I saw this on your website, and I've heard you talk about it on your podcast as well, is the scanning of all of the magazines, the old magazines. Because I'm sure everybody that's watching right now, or listening to the podcast version of this later in the future, probably at least at one point, maybe still, has stacks and stacks and stacks of architecture magazines around. But you and your team, how many pages of magazines have you scanned for the archive?
We have scanned 4 million pages as of a couple of weeks ago. We're like deranged monks who've had too much wine over the old scrolls. And we just keep scanning and scanning and scanning and scanning. And it's been so fun. And the cool part is that for the first time, all these materials are now text searchable by keyword. So you can go inside the magazines and look up a particular architect or house or some detail. And we try to preserve as many of the ads as we can too, because that gives people contemporaneous information on the fixtures and fittings and furniture that existed during the time that the house was published in the magazine.
That is amazing. Go ahead, Catherine.
I was just putting this up here so I didn't lose it. I was muting myself. So you can go ahead and I'll just ask when it comes up, or this kind of fits in, I think, about the timing of modernism and
when we're talking about modernism, it was, so for those of you that don't know, we preview all these conversations on the Clubhouse app every morning in our coffee talk at 9 o'clock in the morning. And we got into this conversation this morning about what is modernism?
Yeah.
So, you know, and Ed's question here, I think, fits right into that.
I can help you solve this problem, Ed.
is there a way to constitute what is mid-century modern?
I mean, I don't pretend to be the final arbiter of this because there's so many opinions, but we use four criteria to establish a modernist house. So the first one is an unusual geometry. It's not just a box with a gable roof on it. Secondly, we're looking for a flat or low-pitched roof. So those two things there knock out most houses. Thirdly, we're looking for abundance of light sources. Many windows, big windows, courtyards, atriums, skylights, anything that makes the outside and the inside tend to merge together. And then finally, although this is nothing new by today's standards, what was radically new back in the day was the idea of the open floor plan, where your living room and your dining room and your kitchen were not separate rooms anymore, but they were part of one continuous space that you could flow around. If a house has those four things, it's probably modernist. And that separates it from, as Ed said, those crappy ranches from the 50s and the 70s.
So how did you, you know, your story, and I alluded to this in the introduction as well, story starts with this chapter of your story starts with a visit to Falling Water. Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpiece up in Pennsylvania. How did you get to Falling Water?
So it actually started about 6 months before that, in January of 2007, one very dark and stormy night when I was minding my own business, Googling, and found a couple of modernist houses near where I live in Raleigh. And they were just fascinating. And there was one in particular, which we now have on our homepage, which was called a Catalano house. And it was this gorgeous house with a hyperbolic paraboloid roof, but it had been destroyed about 5 years previous, which was just tragic. So I thought, wow, something is affecting me here. It was like that scene in Alien where the little monster erupts from the guy's stomach. All of a sudden, architecture had exploded in my DNA. And this was true because my dad was an architect, and I had no interest in architecture before that moment. But all of a sudden, I did. And that turned into an all-night session on the internet. So by 4 a.m, I realized that when I was 6 or 7 years old, my dad had taken me to some of these houses. And I was having these flashbacks now of having been there.
Really? And
so after that, psychological experience, I thought, well, I'll just make a list of houses and try to keep track. And that list turned into a bigger list, and then it turned into a website. And then I went to Falling Water because, you know, you got to make the pilgrimage to Falling Water. And when I came back, that turned into a project to build a new house for me. Hmm. There's that scene in an old movie called Close Encounters of the Third Kind, mm-hmm. where Richard Dreyfuss stays up all night building a monument of Devil's Tower out of mashed potatoes. Well, yep. I drove to Michael's, the craft store, and bought sheets and sheets of foam and some pins and stayed up all night building a model of the house I wanted to have. I call this Falling Water fever. This is what happens when you go and you get possessed of all this. And about 2 years later, I was in that house and I'm talking to you now from it.
I thought you were going to reproduce it in mashed potatoes, but
no. Do you still have the model? That would be hard to do that kind of house in mashed potatoes, I think. But
yeah.
Do you still have the model, George?
I do not have the model. It is gone, but I have some photos of it somewhere.
That would be fun to see those someday.
Yeah. One of the things that we talked about this morning on Clubhouse was, you know what, and Ed said, or Christian said, it's interesting that you gave those four criteria and didn't mention an age, didn't list a date range there.
Right. So I know some people consider modernism to be just all mid-century, but we consider it to be a style rather than a time period. So you've got houses coming out of the ground now that are very modernist in nature.
Okay. Yeah, that's we kind of kicked that around a little bit this morning. When does it start? When does it stop? It's interesting that we call it modernism, and it could be a historical style.
Right. That's a fun debate to have with the city council trying to preserve some of these things.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because some of these modernist houses still look like the future.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're asking a city council to give historical preservation status to something that looks like it's not old, that's a tough sell.
So that's a big part of your movement, if I can call it that, I guess, is the preservation of these structures. And there's some great stories, some language on your website about bulldozers, great and sad, I guess, at the same time, bulldozers, plowing these things down. At what point did that, and I guess it goes back to the house that you just mentioned, losing some of these structures, how prevalent is that in North Carolina, across the United States? Where does that start to become so poignant for you?
Well, it's not as prevalent now as it was before, which we're very, very happy about. Modernism fell out of favor, really, in the late 60s, early 70s. People were tired of it. Material science had not quite caught up to architects. So a lot of houses have been built that had some structural issues or had roof leaks or things like that. Today, material science, you can pretty much build anything that you can design. So it's not so much an issue as it was. And then after that happened, people kind of forgot about mid-century modernist houses for a long time, really until the mid-90s, when they were super cheap and people started either tearing them down and making McMansions or preserving them and bringing them back to life. One of the best examples was in Palm Springs, a Richard Neutra's Kaufman house, which Brent and Beth Harris brought back from almost being deteriorated beyond the point of no return, and invested in it and brought it back to it. Really, its original pristine condition. And that's happened all over the country, not just in Palm Springs. Up until about 2013 here, we were still losing houses. But part of what we did was we started a central registry of houses that were for sale, because our view is you can't save these houses in an 11th hour rescue when the bulldozers are in their front yard. You have to get them at the moment of vacancy and advertise the houses and let people know their history. Many realtors don't know the history of these houses, and so they use our site to figure that out.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember seeing something about needing to have an owner in order to save it. And I'm sure it was stated much, much better than that on your website. But that
you have to have the owner or the owner's family or heirs at least interested in the conversation, because, people's private property is their private property. So it's really their call. Mm-hmm. You can't come in most cases and just, harass them around to save it. But many times there are resources that the owners or family don't know about, different ways to subdivide the property, more efficient methods of fixing a particular property. If you ask your cousin Earl to come over and give you an estimate on your mid-century modernist house, Earl's probably not going to know a lot necessarily about modernist design. So there are people who specialize in this and can give more accurate figures, often less than people have been quoted.
That's interesting. And for those of you both in our live audience now and on the podcast version, one of the things that I love about U.S. Modernist Radio, George's podcast, is the stories of all of these homes, and some saved and some lost. It's really interesting to listen to the story of a specific home. And of course, related to the architect, et cetera. So that's fun.
We also have a series called Children of Genius, where we interview the kids of famous architects.
Oh, that's perfect.
And that's fun to do on multiple levels. I mean, one is we talk about the houses and the buildings, but also we're finding out what it was like to grow up in these households where, you know, the vibe and often the friends that hung out there and the whole way of life was very different.
Mm. Yeah. I heard the episode with Neutra's son.
Just was that Dion or Raymond?
It was Raymond.
Raymond. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dion sadly passed away last year.
Oh, well.
In his 90s.
Okay.
And Raymond is now continuing his father's work through the Neutra Institute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. What's Pam got to say?
Well, she wants to know, she says, do you think the modernism comeback, which I guess we're in, will fade out and then postmodernism will start trending? I'm already seeing signs, she says. So what do you think? She's in California.
Well, you know, I kind of expected the modernism trend to fade before now, but it's really going very strong. Mm. I mean, people are still adopting modernist furniture by the truckload for their homes and apartments. Those have shown no signs of slowing down. Commercial office spaces are now ordering more classic furniture really than they ever have before. And of course, you know, postmodern is getting a little older. Postmodern is what happened after modernism faded out. So building between about 1975 and about 2000, roughly. In 2025, we're going to start hitting the 50-year mark. So that is a threshold at which a lot of preservation standards and designations kick in. And it'd be a really interesting conversation about those buildings and what we should preserve.
I think that is a really interesting question when it comes to preservation. And it strikes me that, you know, maybe part of the problem as well is not only do these modernist homes look like they're from the future instead of from 50 or 60 or older or more years ago, but these are buildings, some of them, and I guess maybe even more specifically the postmodern, we've seen these things been constructed. How can it be that old if I watched them build that building? How could that be historic if I watched that under construction?
Because sadly, Jeff, we are now historic.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I'm going to the council about that. This is a good question from Brian.
Brian wants to know, well, he says, this may seem like a naive question, but I'm curious, other than history, why should these houses be preserved? I'm assuming some things from what he said, but anyway, go ahead and answer that.
Well, you know, we have great examples of many styles that have been preserved. Particularly in the South, the mill houses and the mill villages. A number of those have been saved over time and have really turned around quite well. Victorian houses, that were once all the rage in America. A number of those have been saved. I mean, I think it's important to save the housing trends from each era as we go along. But specifically for modernism, we do a lot of tours, and typically on those tours, there's a couple. And one person in the couple is the modernist, and the other person in the couple has been dragged along by the modernist. And it's just not that much into it, or doesn't quite understand what all the fuss is about. And I would say at least half the time, once they get inside one of these houses and spend a little time and see how it's organized and how the light comes in, they start to understand that the vibe of modernism really is delightful and is quite different from you see in a regular house, even a very nice regular house.
Hmm.
And for that, that's why we think they should be preserved.
Can anyone live in a modern home? A modernist home?
I think so. I don't think there's any restrictions. There's no law.
What if you don't have the right furniture, though? Don't you kind of need to have kind of the right furniture to live in? I mean, to live well in a modernist house?
Well, you know, there are some purists out there who would say you do have to have all the right stuff. But, you know, my bar is pretty reasonable. I just want people to keep these houses from being torn down. If they want to put rooms to go in there, it's fine by me, really. You know, whatever people are comfortable with. Some people like the minimalist approach and keeping things more sparing and putting things out of sight. And some people look like a Cracker Barrel exploded on the inside of their house. Either way is okay.
Cracker Barrel. What is a Cracker Barrel, actually?
It's a restaurant full of knickknacks and cheese.
Oh, you mean the restaurant? Oh, that kind of Cracker Barrel. I thought the namesake of that restaurant was something else. I don't know what a Cracker Barrel is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But here we have this, I don't know who Vapor Rift 007 is, but they say, I think modern homes did not catch on because of materials. I'm seeing more being built now that use rustic materials and finishes. Any thoughts?
That's true. I mean, and there are different variations of modernism. For instance, in Asheville, North Carolina, in the Rocky Mountains, there's this kind of mountain modernism, which uses a lot more stone and great big timbers, which is not like your classical Mies van der Rohe kind of modernism, but very sharp, very nice. And those are amazing to look at.
You mentioned material science catching up, which is, you know, and I think this might have been in the episode about the Ferris Bueller house. And it was the homeowner was talking about replacing the glass, replacing the windows, which, you know, advancements in window technology, I suppose, if we want to say that, or glass technology. And insulation has changed a lot over the years. So what's the biggest challenge when preserving some of these homes? Is it a structural challenge? Is it a retrofitting modern technologies, which seems kind of ironic, but modern technologies into the home? Or what do you see as the biggest challenge?
Well, the two big enemies are always water and heat loss.
Yep.
That's it. Those are the two things you're chasing all the time, and they can take various forms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, was your roof in bad shape? You've got water problems.
Right.
If you got water problems, maybe you have mold and mildew problems too. You know, so it really just sort of depends on the house itself. I would say that a lot of the houses are just fine, but there are a number of them that really develop some issues, and you have to work on those when you remodel them. They're not as elaborate, I think, as some of the houses, say, from the 20s or the Victorians, because they were all wood and didn't have a lot of utilities put in them, at least initially.
Right.
So it's also Victorian houses require an infinite amount of detail to bring back together. And to go visit a recently restored Victorian house is always kind of looking at a work of art.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I live in a historic neighborhood right outside of Indianapolis, right outside of downtown, and we've got quite a span here. There's plenty of Victorian. I saw Ed mentioned earlier a Lustron house. We've got a couple of Lustrons here in the neighborhood.
Oh, good old Lustrons.
Yeah. I don't think we have anything that would. Well, yeah, we do actually have a couple that would, I think, qualify as mid-century. Modern in different corners of the neighborhood.
Now, but, Jeff, you have an entire town, Columbus, Indiana, just south of you.
Yes, 60 miles south of here, modern capital of the world, architecture capital of the world.
Oh, amazing town. Anyone who's into modernism should make a pilgrimage to Columbus, Indiana, and spend a couple days seeing the churches, the houses, the office buildings. Oh, my God, it's unbelievable.
And
I also want to put in a plug for a building in Indianapolis.
Okay.
Which I hope you haven't visited professionally recently. And that's the Eshkenazi Hospital.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's a brand new hospital. And it's just a stunning modern design. I was walking around that place. We got a chance to get a tour with their CEO and the architect. And by the time it was over, I wanted to check into the hospital just for some random illness because it was so amazing. One of the many features in this hospital in Indianapolis was a rooftop garden that you could go up to by elevator and walk around if you were a patient, and they grew food up there that they served in the hospital. Just outstanding.
Yeah, it is amazing. An amazing project. Sorry. And if anybody's headed to Columbus, Indiana, hit me up. I'll meet you there.
Yeah.
It's an hour away from me.
What if you could visualize your building in just a couple of clicks? Remove months from your design process? Or what if you could even create a bridge between stakeholders to solve problems before they even come up? Well, our friends at Twinmotion offer simple, real-time visualization for architects just like you. Their technology lets you view and edit your scene on the go in the same pixel-perfect quality as the final rendering. Twinmotion seamlessly integrates with other tools like SketchUp and Revit, and it transforms your BIM or CAD models into high-quality images and panoramas, standard or 360-degree VR videos, or even your final presentations. Sound complicated? Well, what if I told you that Twinmotion enables anyone to present their biggest ideas in the easiest way possible, no matter what experience you have with graphics softwares? That sounds like something even I could use, but don't take my word for it. Check it out yourself by downloading your exclusive free trial at twinmotion.link/clarity. That's twinmotion.link/clarity to try Twinmotion for free. Monograph is building a community of like-minded firm owners and operations leaders who are looking for solutions that align with their firm's values. On top of that, Monograph is building the only cloud-based practice operations software built exclusively for architects by architects. Monograph's easy-to-use and beautifully designed software allows you and your team to know in near real time whether you are on pace to deliver a project on budget. With Monograph, you and your team can plan project schedules, budgets, role assignments, and team members all in one place. What's the best part of Monograph? And this is a big one for me. It doesn't require a degree in finance to use. To experience the difference today, sign up for a free trial at monograph.com. And to underscore their commitment to the architecture community, on August 12th, Monograph will be hosting their first ever virtual conference. It's called Section Cut. This one-day event brings firm owners, operations leaders, and project leaders together to learn from success stories and workshops, all with the goal of improving their business. Reserve a seat at Section Cut today by visiting sectioncut.com.
Chris really wants to talk about this, so I'm just going to bring up his comment because I know he's passionate about it. So Chris Novelli says, conversation has been mostly modernist houses, but there is a lot of potential in larger scale modernist buildings, brutalist, that can be preserved through transformation and maybe go on to live a better, more integrated, more appreciated life.
Ah, so. Yes, the brutalists.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm a brutalist fan too. I think what has been done in concrete, both past, present, and future, is astounding. And I'm also in the minority. A lot of people really, really, really hate brutalist buildings. They're controversial in most every location they are. Boston has a couple of large major ones that are about 50 years old. And they're having to decide what to do with these buildings. If you go inside, they're really visually very arresting because they were designed by architects such as Paul Rudolph, who was very famous for his concrete structures. On the other hand, a lot of them are not necessarily that practical. They didn't necessarily work well for the purpose which they were intended. They had a variety of heating and air conditioning and moisture problems. Of course, you know, it's one thing to peel back your wall in your house to fix an issue. It's another to try to blast out a couple of feet of concrete to fix another issue. And you also have to keep in mind, like, just like our nation's bridges and tunnels and other concrete structures, some of these have significant deterioration issues, which are quite expensive to fix. So it has to be kind of a tough call for each of the buildings, but I'm a big fan. I really love walking through some of those. And especially in Washington, D.C., they have a number of big brutalist buildings for government agencies. The Housing and Urban Development Building is one, the FBI building, and there are quite a few others. My favorite is the U.S. Tax Court of all buildings, which no one ever goes to visit. But it's this very, very lovely, you hope you don't go to visit. It's this very, very lovely sort of black building that was designed by an architect in Florida, and it's just stunning.
Well, Ed wants to know why everyone else hates brutalism so much. I guess because they haven't gone to architecture school. That would be, I think, why.
I think also part of it is that a number of people have not been inside the buildings. I mean, that really is key. I mean, and I have complete compassion for the people who have to work in some of these buildings where what they're doing is not really compatible with what's going on. I'll give you an example. We have a lovely insurance building in our town. It was built by Home Security Life. And it's just a stunning mid-century modernist building. But they sold it to the Durham police, and it became a police station for the next 25 years. Of course, an insurance company just doesn't work becoming a police station. So, of course, the police hated it, which means the city council hated it. And everybody thought this was a terrible building to get rid of. But fortunately, it has been saved for the moment. And when it gets converted into some kind of original use, like either offices or it could become condos, it'll be spectacular again.
Now, I know because we talked about this morning that so Chris Novelli, who asked the question about brutalism before Ed's question, he did his master's thesis on preserving modernism, which we talked about at the very, very beginning. One of the comments he made this morning was, or one of the questions he had this morning was, can preservation be transformative? And I think, he just made a comment, my point is that preservation doesn't have to be curated. I think his point this morning was, what about, you know, some of these structures where the use does change as part of the preservation, the program possibly, maybe even looking at the original design that may not have actually been carried out the way, you know, the construction may not have been carried out the way it was originally designed. Have you seen any instances with whether it's brutalism or mid-century or some other type of modernism where the preservation of the building was actually accomplished through some sort of transformation like that?
Well, that would require some long-term thinking, Jeff, and some strategic planning.
Took a long time to ask that question.
Yeah. and we're a little short on that in the building field. I mean, people just want to change out the light bulbs and go on with things.
Yeah.
And are not thinking that many chess moves ahead, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. Unless you're doing your master's thesis.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, that is the kind of group. The people that are doing urban studies and master's theses and doctoral dissertations are the ones that are taking the more long-term view and trying to give us better ideas about how to preserve these things ahead of the time that they're in trouble.
Yeah, that's a great point. So Leslie has a question.
Yes, Leslie says, can you talk about color? I'm a fan of Southwest modernism with Adobe and Pueblo influence and Luis Barragan lighting the way with desert color. So,
oh yes, there are a lot of wonderful. I'll just pick one state, Arizona architects. Will Bruder, Rick Joy, Frank Lloyd Wright had his Taliesin West there, and just like you know, the goal of many architects is to have houses in particular blend in with their environment. So that was also the goal of these architects in making the materials that were used blend in with the desert colors, the desert textures, and of course, on a practical basis, be able to withstand the sun because that gets pretty high, especially now when it's getting into the 120s and 130s in different places.
Yeah, that's beautiful architecture. One thing that, you know, as I think about what you've created with U.S. Modernist, you know, going back to the, you know, one stormy night, a dark and stormy night and the Google search, I don't, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I think what you sort of created a movement here, or at least you're curating a movement or somehow facilitating a movement. What does it take? And it may have been on when you and Catherine were talking on her podcast that, you know, what you're doing is all about modernism. But somebody else could say, hey, I'd really love Victorian architecture.
Right.
And they could create U.S. Victorian or, you know,
exactly.
Something. Right. What does it take to do what you're doing, you know, whether it's create a movement or what, however you would define it?
Well, you have to have a little OCD. That's the first step. Because if you're not willing to, like, dive headfirst into the pool with no life preserver and not even sure if there's water in the pool, then this is not for you. But with that said, it really is simple, and I'm encouraging people to do this all the time with various interests. They call me and ask how to do it. Contrary to popular belief, you don't need to be an architect. You don't need to be a historian. You don't need to have a degree in anything. You just need basically a car, a cell phone, and a camera of some kind, probably your cell phone, and start driving around your community, taking photos from the street of different houses and noting the addresses. And then you can look those up and you can start building documentation on the houses. It's also helpful to talk with the older architects in town because they remember all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I talk with people who are in their 90s and they don't remember who their wife is, but they can tell you every house that they designed over the last 50 years, plus who they're pissed at from 1969.
I don't doubt that a bit. So when you look back, you know, going back to the dark and stormy night,
yeah,
what do you think? And hopefully there's momentum. You know, that's my hope, that what you've done is generate momentum, and you know, I assume you're going to be at this for quite a while.
At least through tonight, yes.
Depending on how the storms go.
That's right.
What's been the result of scanning millions of pages and doing tours? We haven't even talked about tours yet, but doing tours and a podcast and the archive and everything else. What's the result of all of this work?
So the result is that people have a place to go to find out the information that they need. And when I started this, and I started the various projects that we have, our master's gallery for houses, our magazine library for architecture magazines, and the podcast, every time I thought, surely someone's already done this before to this extent. And I was surprised to figure out that in most cases they hadn't. I mean, for instance, there were several architecture podcasts that were in existence, but they tended to be really, really serious. And like, you know, I wanted something that was a little more lighthearted and fun. And I thought, well, I'll just start this and see how it goes. And maybe we'll get a few listeners. With the magazine project, which is, you can get on our website, usmodernist.org/library. That came out of a phone call with a Charlotte realtor. He had heard that we were into this mid-century thing. And he's calling from the basement and he says, I'm down here in the basement. There are boxes and boxes of magazines here. I think some of them are wet. Do you want them? It's like, I had to think a minute and go, well, sure. Because, you know, if they were bad, I'd throw them away. I mean, what the hell? So we got what ended up being about 500,000 pages of magazines in that first great haul. And most of them were in fine shape. They weren't wet. So I went on eBay and I bought 5 scanners for like $50 a piece, old Epson models. And we set up in my garage and aided by alcohol, we fed about 500,000 pages into these machines. And that started our first collection of magazines. And since then, we've expanded and have more volunteers. We have a scanning company now that does all the actual work from that. But we still have to process the magazines to get them ready for scanning. So, for instance, when they come in, we have to shear the bindings off because we don't have – it would take many lifetimes to do it page by page. And then we had to pluck out all the subscription cards and perfume samples and product samples and AOL CDs from the 1990s and get all the crap out so that the magazine can actually be sheet fed into a big scanner.
Wow.
And then once that happens, it gets uploaded to the web and it gets indexed by Google with all our keywords. And that means, you know, people can now use it. So, you know, that just started as a random phone call from a random Charlotte realtor. And now we got 4 million pages. So
are you still accepting magazines?
My wife sadly says yes. You know, they show up all the time, Jeff. I mean, like, we've had pickup trucks come to the garage and just want to offload. and we take them. And it works out great. You know, we get them from all over the country. A few have come from abroad, but it's expensive to ship magazines. Mm-hmm. The Postal Service has something called media mail that people can use to ship things cheaply to us. I just got in 2 boxes today. So they'll go into the giant machine and get processed and be up, you know, in a little while later. Our most recent thing I'm most proud of recently with this is that we've been working with AIA National for a number of years, and they just sent us 700,000 pages of magazines from their basement. So these were all the state magazines like AIA Indiana and AIA Iowa and AIA Chicago that, you know, they don't have any room for really much anymore and lent them to us to scan. So we're going to scan all those and send them back. That means they don't have to do it. So it's a good partnership.
Nice. Nice. So are there, this is almost like baseball card collecting at this point. Yeah. Are there certain magazines that you want, that you're looking for, or is it all serendipitous donations?
Oh, no. We have a page. It's usmodernist.org/needed. And you can go to that page and see all the ones that we need.
Okay.
So it's all cross-referenced and updated. This is where the OCD comes into place, Jeff. We have all those details handled.
So for everybody that's out there, either in our live audience or in the on the podcast later, actually, this is a message for your significant others. If you want to get rid of those stacks of magazines that you're significant other keeps hoarding, go to usmodernist.org/needed and see if George needs those magazines.
That's there, right. That's right. Someone just put the link up for us. So thank you. Thank you, Facebook user, anonymous.
You're welcome. That was me.
Okay.
Not so anonymous.
I usually stay anonymous, but you know, when I'm, you know, getting thanked, I have to step up and say,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I'd like to help.
she's here to help.
I'm here to help.
That's great.
Someone just asked about Iowa Architect magazine, and we just got that one. We hope to have it online sometime during August or September, and we have 30 years of that now. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's amazing. No, it is really amazing that all that is scanned and we can all use it. I mean, we can all use it. We can just access it. For
right,
free.
It's just right there.
That's right there.
I figured out early on that this was not going to work as any kind of financial model. People do not want to pay for this kind of information at all. So we just abandoned that from the get-go.
Well, how is U.S. Modernist supported then?
So we're supported. We have members. People can join the organization. We have very wonderful donors that help us with funding for various projects, including the scanning project. And our main source of income is from our tours. So we take people on modernist tours all around the U.S., Europe, and this fall we're going to the Middle East. We're taking people to Dubai for the World's Fair, which is going to be just amazing. And then in America, we take people to Falling Water every year. We take people to All Brass in South Carolina, which is another Frank Lloyd Wright project. We take people to Palm Springs for Modernism Week, which is kind of the Super Bowl of modernism every year. And we go to L.A., New York, Chicago, And then we have lots and lots of local events here in North Carolina, and that's where the bulk of our revenue comes from.
Okay.
Well, so, I was thinking that we could have an entree architect tour. I'm just throwing that out there and planting the seed, George.
Okay.
And everybody else.
Well, we have ways we could do that.
Indeed. Yeah, I think we should do that. Not this summer because we have our thing planned already, of course. It's short notice, but maybe maybe next year.
Yeah, sure.
Yep. I think we can do that. That sounds like a great idea.
So Ed Shannon says, what do you do with the magazines after you scan them? Don't tell my wife, but I will take them. Oh, Ed. Ed.
Ed, have you been listening? That's millions of pages.
Yeah. So, Ed, if you ever want to contact me and come pick up some of these things and put them in your pickup truck and take them back home, you are more than welcome. Because we have to recycle them, really, after we're done with them. They're not rare in terms of being sort of financially valuable, and they're in lots and lots and lots of architectural libraries. But we were the first to scan them and make them available digitally to everybody.
Ed, we won't tell your wife, but you might want to be careful.
Yeah. Hope she's not on Facebook, Ed.
She probably listens to this podcast, Ed.
Yeah, now. Exactly.
I'm pretty sure. I think she's live right now.
You're going to have some explaining to do, Ed.
She shows up as Facebook user. And she just asked a question, Catherine. Ed's wife asked.
What did she ask?
Did we invite George to Eccelstock?
Oh, yeah. No. George, would you like to come to Eccelstock? It's in very northern Vermont at a resort with a water park. I don't know how modern it is. I haven't been there, but it doesn't seem like it'll fit with that. But anyway, Jeff will be there. I'll be there. And
is this
number
where we have to crawl in the mud while rock and roll plays around us?
Yes.
Oh,
actually.
The summer of love.
Yeah. August 13th. I can send you the details later, George.
Please
but
do.
We would love it if you would come.
Well, please.
Seriously,
do.
It would be kind of fun if you were there.
I wasn't aware of it, so
it's going to be it's going to be architecture and music.
Okay,
In all seriousness, yep.
Yeah, that's true.
Live music and talking about architecture.
Yeah, t-shirts too.
T-shirts, Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
I have t-shirts.
Ben and Jerry's. Jeff's coming all the way from Indiana just for the tour of the factory, which is unfortunately closed due to COVID. Aww. But I guess we'll go to just the outdoor window.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's close enough.
It's better than going to Kroger.
Yeah, true.
Well, I'll send you the details.
Kroger.
This episode brought to you
by Kroger.
By Kroger, your modern grocery store.
Yeah. Exactly.
So this is kind of an interesting question from Rod, not surprisingly, but he says, do you have any archival documentation on former military base housing, much of which is MCM and most are occupied?
And the answer is yes. We have tons of information on this because mid-century modern architects designed a lot of military housing between about 1955, roughly. It was a move to modernize the campuses of the bases. And they were all published generally in some of the architecture magazines and also in some of the military magazines, which we don't have. But you can find references to those in the magazine library if you know the name of the base. And a lot of these bases had neighborhood names, you know, like Battleship Acres or, you know, something like that. And you could look up the little neighborhood within the base.
Battleship
Okay.
Yeah, Battleship Acres.
Okay.
It's a lovely little community.
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine that.
On the water.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Cookouts on Saturdays. Yeah.
Absolutely. Chris asked a question a minute ago, since we're still sort of in the magazine mode about. Do you have any university contacts? They may have some of the things that you're missing.
Well, they do, but they don't want to let go of them.
Yeah, and get chopped up. And
so we tend to specialize in universities that are closing libraries. So I got a call a year ago from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. It was closing one of their library buildings. And a very wonderful librarian there was distraught about the fact they were going to throw away, you know, thousands and thousands of magazines. And although we paid for it, she arranged us to ship 46 boxes of those magazines from Oahu that we got and digitized. And that was a wonderful contribution by the university.
Oh, nice.
I want to speak to Chris about the rabbit holes that he's going down in looking at the collection. So this is a common problem. We are a little dangerous to visit because it's highly addictive to get on our site. I get emails at least a few times a week from someone who discovered it, say 9:30 at night, and by 3:30 in the morning they're sending me an email going, "Oh my God, I can't shut this thing off." So be careful when you log on because it could be a while.
Warning! You've been warned, everyone.
Yeah, you've been warned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like there ought to be a lot of warnings that go along with this conversation today.
Yes. The following material may be disturbing.
May disturb you into the wee hours of the morning. Oh, this has been a lot of fun, conversation, and it's fascinating to learn about the journey. And you know, I go back to what you said just a few minutes ago, starting with a cell phone in your car. You know, driving mm-hmm. around. You know, that may be a big takeaway for anybody, whether modernism is your thing or lust run,
whatever it is,
Whatever it is. Yeah.
I love that idea. A lot of people say, well, I don't know how to start a website. Well, you can go to Google Sites, Sites. And if you can operate Microsoft Word, you can operate you can operate Google Sites. And it's a drag and drop interface that you can plug in text and photos and build yourself a very simple little site. And you can upload all those photos that you were taking from your car. And then send it to your friends and say, you know, do you know who designed this house? Do you know when the house was built? Anything like that. And that's just how it gets started. And then once people know that there's a place they can contribute to, then it's when you get volunteers. And we've had dozens, maybe several hundred really wonderful volunteers over the years that have contributed mm-hmm. through that crowdsourcing kind of way.
Yeah, that's great.
Byron is saying, do you take furniture? And the answer is, yes, we do. During the pandemic, we started accepting donations of mid-century modern furniture. And we have a truck and a crew, and we'll go pick it up from different places. And what we do is we auction it off, and the funds go to looking at our preservation and documentation operations.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Yeah, that's very cool. So now everybody that's looking for furniture for your house, buy it on auction from usmodernist.com.
Right. We get tons of, you know, the classic stuff, Noguchi tables, Barcelona chairs, Eames chairs, Corbusier loungers.
Mm. All right. I'm going down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just said .com. It's actually .org. So usmodernist.org. Sorry for the misstep there, but John says this has been a fun and interesting talk, and I agree. George, thank you very much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun, and you know, I'm looking forward to the next episode of US Modernist Radio and the music that will go with it as well. So for everybody out there, remember usmodernist.org. Is where you can find all of this information that we've been talking about today. The archives are there, information on the tours, the master's gallery, which we barely touched on, and you can check all of that out there. You know, use at your own risk. You may not come back. You may not be seen for quite a while. But
that's right. We do have a 12-step program for people that get into it too far. Like, hi, I'm George, and I'm a modernist.
That's under the resources tab at usmodernist.org.
Right.
And also, wherever you consume podcasts, U.S. Modernist Radio. It really is. It's a delightful podcast. It's a lot of fun.
It is. Yep. It's a lot more fun than a lot of architecture podcasts. You are very right about that, George. Well, I really like it.
There's a theme song, and I sing it really badly, so you have that to look forward to.
I was wondering if that was you. It sounds like you.
Yeah. Stay in the credits at the end.
Can you sing it right now, George, a little?
Oh, wow. Okay. Here we go. Mama don't need no architecture around here. Mama don't need no architecture around here. Oh, I don't care what mama don't allow. Gonna make mine modern anyhow. Mama don't need no architecture around here. There you go.
That's beautiful.
And with that, we should adjourn quickly before the hordes come.
The servers are lighting up. Oh, thank you for that, George. Really appreciate that. That's the best ending to the show we've ever had. And I see that Nicole has jumped over to Twitch so she can be a troll now. So that's the first step, Nicole. Yeah, congratulations. Her trolling career is well on its way. So, George, again, thanks. Really appreciate you. Thanks for U.S. Modernist, honestly. And to all of you out there, thank you again for showing up after this 2-week break. Appreciate all of you for all of your comments, all of your questions. I'll be back again tomorrow. Actually, Catherine and I both will be back again tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel, 4 p.m. Eastern. Tomorrow, we will take up our miniseries again called Member Spotlights, and we'll have a mystery member tomorrow. And as long as Jeff doesn't ruin the game, we will we'll try to guess who the mystery member in the spotlight is tomorrow. So join us for that. Until then, I appreciate all of you. Take care of yourselves. Be well, be safe. Still a lot of stuff going on out there. So keep yourself safe and well and those around you as well. And take a little bit of time to breathe tonight. Rejuvenate somehow. Come back again because we're going to do this all over again tomorrow. So thank you, everybody. Appreciate all of you. And we'll see you again somewhere sometime soon.
Before we go, I want to say thank you to Twinmotion for their support of this episode of Context and Clarity Live. Visit Twinmotion today at twinmotion.link/clarity and try Twinmotion for free. And also, thank you to Monograph for their support of this podcast episode. To reserve a seat at their first ever interactive virtual conference, visit sectioncut.com today. Thanks for listening to this week's Context and Clarity Live episode. Selfishly, I love these conversations because I get to be the go-between between you and some really incredible guests. To that end, I want to know what you think about today's guest. Message me on the socials. I'm really easy to find. I'm Jeff_Eccles everywhere. If you happen to run across a white-haired chiropractor from Austin, Texas, yeah, that's not me. I'm the other Jeff Eccles. Oh, and if you have an idea for a future guest, tell me who it is and why you think they'd be a good guest for one of these conversations. Maybe we can get them on a future episode. Thanks again for listening. I appreciate you, and I'll see you next week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick. So when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England is diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.